It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hatred. It manifests itself in flyers distributed in certain neighborhoods, in internet postings, and as we are too well aware, through violent, deadly acts. Is the hate movement increasing in the Pittsburgh region, across the country? Kathleen Blee is a researcher, professor of sociology, and dean of the Dietrich School of Arts and Sciences and the College of General Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. She's also the author of several books and studies, including Organized Racism, Women in the Hate Movement, Making Democracy, How Activist Groups Form, and more recently, Understanding Racist Activism. Kathleen Blee, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you.
As a sociologist, as somebody who researches the hate movements, the social movements, can you sort of just give us a brief glimpse of the extent of hate, of racist and anti-Semitism activity today?
So what I study are people who are organized in groups or networks for the explicit purpose of disseminating racism, anti-Semitism, anti-immigrant, and anti-Islamic rhetoric. And that movement is growing quite quickly and mostly through the internet and social media right now. That movement has existed throughout U.S. history. It's ebbed and flowed, but right now it's in an ascendancy.
Do you look locally, nationally? What is your scope?
My focus is broadly across the United States, although increasingly this movement is a global movement. So studying it in the United States means paying attention to its global connections. Ideas, people, even weapons circulate across this movement, across borders.
You've studied these movements at different time periods, I believe, back in the 1920s as well as right now. Can you give us an idea? Are they consistent from the 20s to now the 20-teens?
So the 1920s was the period of the largest racist movement in the United States, the Ku Klux Klan, which in that period had approximately 3 million members.
Mm-hmm.
To be a member, you had to be white, native-born, and Protestant. And that was a pretty good percentage of the population that was eligible that joined the Klan. So it was very different movement in the sense that it was a majoritarian movement in many areas in which the Klan took hold, primarily in the North, not as people might think in the South. So it was a middle-class movement. It was a pretty open movement. Today, the racist movement is more undercover. It's not a majority movement. It is alarmingly large, but it's certainly a very marginal movement in the society. Its power comes from its hatred, its violence, but not from its numerical power.
Interesting. Not hidden, so not hidden underneath cloaks and hoods like we always picture.
Right, right.
Has the hatred been provoked differently? What has provoked the hatred, shall we say, then and now?
So in the 1920s, that's a period of large amount of immigration, mostly from Europe, and migration of African Americans from the South to the North. So the Klan was organized around anti-Semitism, anti-immigrant, anti-African-American, and anti-Catholic ideas. So it was also organized to take political power. So there the Klan participated in elections. In fact, they elected officials across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Today's movement is still, as we know, very anti-Semitic, very racist, very anti-immigrant. It's not particularly anti-Catholic anymore. That's a real change.
We often hear the term white nationalist. Is that an accurate term? Is that appropriate?
That's actually a term that the movement often uses to describe itself, and it's, in my opinion, misleading. So some of the groups in this movement are nationalistic, but many of them actually are not nationalist. So, for example, some of the groups that I study will talk about the U.S. federal government as ZOG, Z-O-G,
mm-hmm.
by which they mean Zionist occupation government,
right.
They see the federal government as their enemy, not as something that they're trying to protect. So in that sense, they are not nationalists, in fact, sort of anti-nationalists. So nationalism is a contested arena in the modern far right in the United States. It's not correct to think of them all as white nationalists.
When you were comparing just a couple minutes ago about 8-9 decades ago and today, the hate movement, you referenced today and you talked about a bit about social media. Has that exacerbated the problem?
It's both exacerbated and changed the nature of what you might broadly think of as white supremacism. So it's made its reach much, much further. So it took a certain kind of person to join the Ku Klux Klan or join a neo-Nazi group in up through the 1990s. It was a risk. You really had the fear that people would know that you were involved in that kind of politics. It's a very different phenomenon now where you could just go to your phone or go to your computer and with a few clicks be deep within that world of very violent, deeply racist ideas without anyone knowing it. So people form connections much more invisibly and with less fear of exposure than they had in the past.
There's been a lot of talk recently about social media and banning hate speech. Any thoughts on that?
It's very hard to ban speech. And one thing we know about this world is they're always one step ahead of the curve. So they're very good at disguising their trail. So you can focus on one term or one kind of speech, by which time they've moved on to some other different kind of meme. On the other hand, what is going on in some of these social media platforms is extremely dangerous and is, in fact, helping people target enemies and develop a sense of urgency to combat those enemies. It's leading to violence. So banning, I don't think, is a good solution, but there are interesting things happening in social media world where people are being redirected to algorithms away from the most violent parts of those that media, and I think that's very encouraging direction.
As you study the hate movement, do you look at numbers or areas of the country, the activities themselves, the messages that are sent out? What are you focusing on as you study?
So my work is focused on understanding these groups from the inside. So I don't study just their propaganda. I talk to people in those groups. I observe them. I hang out with them. And I'm interested in the different stages. I'm interested in why people join and how they join, how they get swept in. I'm interested in what those groups do inside, which is often different than what their propaganda suggests. And I'm interested in recent years in how people exit, what pulls people out, what makes people successful in leaving those groups versus pulled back into those groups.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Kathleen Blee, researcher, dean of the Dietrich School of Arts and Sciences and the College of General Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. She's the author of several books and studies exploring the hate movement. What I want to ask you about the lone wolf concept as opposed to groups, has that impacted your research?
The lone wolf concept is actually quite a misleading concept. It implies that people read something and then they act purely on their own. So they're kind of self-motivated mm-hmm. to violence. But if you look at people who commit racist and anti-Semitic violence, including, unfortunately, in our own community, what you find is they're not really lone wolves. They're spurred by, they're mobilized by, and their hatred is channeled by this world of internet white supremacism that is carefully crafted to push some people in that direction. So it's very misleading to think of them as independent actors. They're really a product of a larger a world of hatred.
We have just about 2 minutes left. Earlier, I mentioned among your works that you've authored or co-written is Organized Racism, Women in the Hate Movement. How did you get interested in that topic?
So that's one of the hidden parts of the hate groups that is quite invisible if all you do is look at their propaganda or their public postings or interview the leaders, all of which are men. But if you look inside these groups, what you find is a surprising number of members are women. In visible groups, maybe about 25% of the members are women. And they often play pretty important instrumental roles in that group. They never have titles. They're never called leader. But they're very effective at recruiting people. And they're very effective in holding those groups together. So in some ways, they are the glue that's held some of these movements together and has given them their very terrible power. So I'm interested in trying to uncover that aspect of organized racism.
Not the typical image that we might have when we think about the picture of somebody who is involved in hate.
Indeed, it's not.
1 minute to go. I want to ask you, what questions still nag at you that you want to find answers to?
What I'm most interested right now is trying to understand the increasingly global nature of white supremacism. So most of us have focused country by country, but it's clear that they are being, they're learning lessons from each other, they're developing strategies from each other, and I'm increasingly working with people, scholars in other countries, to try to understand how those strategies and ideas and people move across borders.
So borders don't stop it.
Borders don't stop it.
Kathleen Blee is a researcher, dean of the Dietrich School of Arts and Sciences, as well as the College of General Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. She's the author of several books and studies exploring the hate movement. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. The race is on for the Allegheny County District Attorney seat. The current DA, Stephen Zappala, has held the job for 2 decades, but his challenger, Teron Jenkins, says it's time for a change. Then, Pennsylvania lawmakers are once again debating the issue of how state appellate judges should get their seats. And Pennsylvania's Department of Corrections has announced a new policy that will allow inmates addicted to opioids to receive medication-assisted treatment. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
The Grateful Dead played their first shows in 1965 and steadily built a fan base so loyal they would quit their jobs and follow the group around the country. However, the Dead never really had a hit song. At least they didn't until the late 1980s. On this day in 1987, after a concert in Monterey, California, the Grateful Dead called their audience back in to watch a second encore of sorts, a video shoot for their new song, Touch of Grey. The first performance was pretty standard, but the second one featured the band's skeleton likenesses, known as the Dead Ringers. The video was a hit on MTV, and the Dead got their first top 40 song. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Each year, ponds of water form in winter and early spring, then dry up in the summer. They don't look like much to us, but they're crucial to animals like frogs and salamanders. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Reporter Ann Danahy went on a field trip in Center County to find out what goes on after dark at these vernal pools and understand why they matter.
Jim Julian is taking a group through the woods on a path cut by power lines in search of vernal pools and the creatures that live there in the spring.
What I'm going to ask that if when you're walking, take a look with your flashlights. Make sure that you're looking on the ground because this is the time of year that these animals are migrating.
An assistant professor of biology at Penn State Altoona, Julian has been leading the Clearwater Conservancy tours for about 15 years. As we make our way in, Julian tells the group to listen.
Those are wood frogs. So you'll hear these guys calling back and forth, and then occasionally you might hear that high-pitched of a spring peeper.
Julian says that once there's a snowmelt and the temperatures are above 40, the animals leave where they've been hibernating to find the same pool year after year. At the pond, Julian tells us to fan out without getting our feet in the water.
And if you put your flashlights out under the open water, you'll get some eye shine back from the male wood frogs when they come up above water to call.
The frogs hear us at first and quiet down, so while we're waiting for them to resume their serenades, the salamanders make an appearance.
So once you get that search pattern for what these guys look like, they'll just be everywhere. Oh, there's a Jefferson right there. There's a Jefferson right below the spotted, right there.
Julian says it's the first time he's caught a Jefferson at the pond. It's longer than a spotted one, but not as hefty. The vernal pools, he notes, also have a rich array of aquatic insects, including diving beetles and small crustaceans called fairy shrimp. It doesn't take long for the frogs to overcome their shyness and start calling again.
I got one. I think I got a frog.
Here's the little guy that's making all that noise. One of the little guys.
Julian is holding a small male wood frog.
Listen. What you're hearing from everyone else is their typical mating call.
One animal you won't find in a vernal pool is fish, which is good. They would make lunch out of the other animals' eggs. But Julian notes vernal pools and the animals they attract are part of the food chain. As amphibians dine on the invertebrates in the vernal pool, they too become food for other creatures. Susie Yetter is Conservation Projects Coordinator at Clearwater Conservancy, which offers the field trip.
One of the biggest challenges with vernal pools is they are ephemeral. They're temporary. They tend to be very small. People completely overlook them. They don't know that they're there.
That means someone could build on or around one without even realizing it. But even with the development, the frogs and salamanders will want to take the same path. That could mean crossing roads and developments.
They may appear to be these isolated little aquatic islands, but they're very important pieces of the landscape, and it's important to understand how to manage them for habitat, how to keep them connected to one another and to other natural areas in the forest, and to make sure that you also focus on the upland surrounding that pool.
Nicole Delario of State College was one of the people on the outing. She said the frog chorus stood out.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't believe how it started off as one, and then everyone else joined in. That was amazing to hear that.
While there were plenty of frogs and salamanders at the vernal pool that evening, they don't stay for long. Once they've bred, they return to the woods until next year.
That was Ann Danahy of WPSU, and there's more of our wildlife reporting at AlleghenyFront.org/wildPA. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapel.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It didn't take long after a white police officer shot and killed a black unarmed teen last summer for activists to identify what they say was a second culprit.
This is a referendum on District Attorney Stephen Zappone.
90.5 WESA's Unley Herring reports, the Allegheny County DA now faces a primary election challenger in Democrat Teron Jenkins.
Zappala charged East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rossfeld with homicide 1 week after Rossfeld fatally shot Antoine Rose. By then, activists were already calling for the DA's removal. But Zappala says he had to proceed with caution.
But that family didn't even have the ability to bury their son. And people are calling for criminal charges. I'll take care of this, but I'm going to give you the opportunity to bury your child.
The officer was acquitted in March, and critics fault prosecutors for not calling a use of force expert as a witness. But Zappala says the three experts his office contacted were unwilling to testify. And he says his office takes police shootings seriously. He cites two other times where it prosecuted officers who shot unarmed civilians in the back. In one of those cases, the officer was acquitted. In the other, the officer pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter. But Brandy Fisher of the Alliance for Police Accountability says there have been too many other cases where Zappala has sided with police.
He needs them to win his cases. It makes no sense that we then would ask someone to turn around and forcefully charge their friends.
Fisher trusts that challenger Teron Jenkins would be different. The candidate drew support from activists early on, but he stumbled with some progressives when he said that homosexuality is a sin. Jenkins has ties to a deeply conservative church and apologized for those remarks last month. He emphasizes he would have found an expert to testify at Rosfeld's trial.
I believe that we should all be held to the same standard. It shouldn't matter your occupation. We should all be held to the same standard, equal accountability across the board.
Jenkins previously served as Chief Deputy Director for the Allegheny County Public Defender's Office. Before that, he was an Assistant District Attorney for 2 years. He says if elected, he would push harder than Zappala for treatment programs and community service as alternatives to incarceration.
I've always said that the criminal justice system should be more focused on people who are violent and people who are dangerous, as opposed to the people that make mistakes or suffer from mental health or drug addiction or poverty.
Zappala says he's pursued those very reforms since becoming DA in 1998. For example, he sought to reduce the use of cash bail. He also launched programs like Drug Court and Mental Health Court, which connect eligible defendants with treatment and community support.
And that's one of the reasons I wanted to start all these programs. So people, you know, we can understand this person's condition, this person's family, what their needs are.
Pitt Law professor and WESA legal analyst David Harris says Zappala once was on the cutting edge of reforms. But the national conversation about criminal justice and its racial and class disparities has shifted.
He was always vocal on a number of these issues and made some changes here in his county that were reforms of a very significant type. Now we have many more people proposing those and more.
Antoine Rose's death brought racial tensions to the surface last summer and prompted weeks of protests. Some recall similar turmoil in 1995 when black motorist Johnny Gamage died at the hands of suburban police. Criminal defense attorney Bob Del Greco represented Gamage's family. He says they were disappointed when Zappala decided not to retry one of the officers after a mistrial. But Del Greco says state law makes it hard to win such cases.
And probably with a couple decades of hindsight and reflection, I'd probably be willing to concede that it was the correct decision, although at the time, it didn't feel that way.
As for the perspectives of law enforcement, the Pittsburgh Fraternal Order of Police Union is not endorsing either candidate in the May 21st primary. Anli Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Let the voters continue to decide or have the politicians decide? I'm talking about judges. That's the question that seems to pop up in every legislative session. And this session is no different, except with a bit of a twist. There are competing bills. Joining us on the line from Harrisburg to help us sort out this is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief Katie Meyer. Good morning, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
So, Katie, a proposal to switch from a statewide election by voters to appointment, merit selection, that does come up regularly, does it not?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, this has been something that we've seen several years in a row. And even before that. But now we have this, as you mentioned, this competing bill that would keep the election system, but sort of really switch it up a lot.
There were supposed to be votes this week. That was on the House calendar. What happened?
So there were votes on the alternative bill. So I should say the merit selection bill and the other bill is one that would keep elections but make it regional. And the regional bill, it's sponsored by a guy named Russ Diamond, a Republican. That's the bill that ended up getting votes. So it hasn't passed the House yet, but it went on second consideration, which means they, pitched a lot of amendments to it, and there might still be a few more to come. But that appears to be the bill that they want to move. So the other bill, the merit selection bill, Paul Schemmel, another Republican, had that one. He tried to edit it to make it appeal more to people who liked Diamond's idea. He inserted some stuff that would give districts to the selection process. But that one didn't get moved at all. So it really does look like they're going to go with Diamond's bill, the election one.
All right. Election, but not statewide. It would be by district, correct?
Exactly. Yes. Diamond, he did pitch what the districts might look like. So the purpose of this is it addresses a long long-standing frustration that a lot of rural lawmakers have, which is that most judges do come from Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, mostly Philly, and they say, well, we need to make it more fair. We need judges that come from the areas that we're from. And so he thinks this is going to correct some, you know, wrong that he sees with the current system.
Would the districts, because there's different number of judges on each of the appellate courts, seven in the Supreme Court, correct? Would there be different districts for each of the appellate courts?
There would be, yes. So they would, you know, they would maintain the same number of judges in each of the courts. And so they would all be districted. So there, you know, you said there's seven judges. So it would be seven districts broken up by population around the state. It is unclear how those districts would exactly be drawn, because we're also having a separate conversation about changing how we do redistricting in Pennsylvania. So whatever system we settle on for redistricting broadly for congressional districts and state house and Senate ones, we would probably also do for the judicial stuff. But that's all, it's all very up in the air.
Yeah, so what people have been looking forward to, drawing of another map, right?
Uh-huh, I know. That's the best thing for Harrisburg right now.
Final question, Katie. So if Diamond's bill does get passed, we're still a long way off, though, because this would actually have to change the Constitution, correct?
Absolutely, Kevin. Yeah, this would have to be a constitutional amendment. And as many listeners probably know, that means it'll have to be passed in consecutive two-year sessions. So it could be as much as 4 years. And it has to be passed with the exact same language. So if they pass it this session, they can't change it when they pass it again. Then it goes to voters for a referendum.
Katie Meyer is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief in Harrisburg. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, a federal appeals court addressed the right to treatment for an inmate who suffers from opioid addiction, a move that legal advocates say could have wide repercussions. Joining us to talk about implications for Pennsylvania is University of Pittsburgh law professor and WESA legal analyst David Harris. David, welcome back to The Confluence.
Kevin, good to be with you.
All right, it started in a Boston court talking about a rural jail in Maine that addresses the right to treatment for opioid addiction while incarcerated. David, is this the huge step that some analysts are saying it might be?
Well, it could be. This is a case that has now come out of the Federal Court of Appeals or the First Circuit, which covers Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Puerto Rico. So it's limited geographically, but this is part of a larger argument about both health care inside jails and prisons, and also about the proper role of drugs and medication in treatment for the opioid addiction we're seeing as a plague across the entire country. So to the extent that we're facing that in so many places, this will be looked at as a leading case, even if it doesn't bind any particular state except its four that it was decided in.
Now, the ACLU in Maine argued that withholding treatment would violate the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution. Under the ADA, it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of disability, and this includes people who have gone through or are going through drug rehabilitation. Did that seem like a strong argument from the ACLU to you?
Yes, and that's because this is a congressional statute. The Americans with Disabilities Act has been basically strengthened over time since its passage with regard to what it covers. And particularly, there have been controversies for years about whether addiction is a disease or whether it is something else. And I think in our society generally, particularly with the opioid crisis, we think of this as much more of a disease occurrence than a moral failing. That used to be the other way of looking at addiction. Now we're looking at it as a health problem, as a disability even, that needs to be treated. The other argument that they made in this case was based on the Eighth Amendment, and that's cruel and unusual punishment for these purposes. And you can't simply put people in prison and say, we're not going to give you proper medical treatment. You cannot withhold that in a way that is arbitrary. And that's really what this argument would be. So there was both a statutory and and a constitutional argument, which made for a convincing argument before the First Circuit.
And again, the First Circuit, New England area.
Yes.
But what can you tell us, realizing you're a legal expert, not a health professional,
sure.
But what's happening right now, whether it's Allegheny County Jail or our state prisons, as far as treatment for inmates?
Well, without getting into specifics, because we're talking about so many different counties, each with their county facility or one that they share with another county, in our state prison system, what's happening generally is that the prison system is becoming overwhelmed with addiction cases in the form of the inmates that they are housing. As the police arrest and bring people in for criminal offenses who have an addiction problem, these people, some large percentage of them, end up in our prisons and our jails. Mm-hmm. And our jails and prisons are not set up as addiction treatment facilities. We have the same thing happening and have had it happening for a long time with mental health. Lots of people with mental health issues end up in prisons and jails. And prisons and jails have now become so overwhelmed with these other kinds of social problems that would really be more appropriate to other kinds of social agencies, that they face the choice. Do we treat them? Do we treat them properly? How do we do that when we're not set up for that? And it's a very, very difficult set of issues. So you see more and more prisons and jails saying, okay, if we're going to be a place with lots of addicts, unless we treat them, they're going to end up on the street someday with the same problem. And how are we going to be better off?
But are the prisons, are the staff equipped to do this, though?
No. I mean, in a word, no. I mean, there are very good, very dedicated professionals within the correction system who have jobs of helping people with addiction treatment and other kinds of social issues. They do the best that they can. But do we have enough of them? Do we give them enough resources? Do we have programs of a scale that can really treat the full problem when people are in prisons? No. And to the extent that we're taking this issue, making it, instead of a public health issue, a criminal justice issue, and just putting people in the criminal justice pipeline instead of treating them on the outside, where we could do so at far less cost and more effectively and keep them connected with families and jobs and so forth, it's not a good choice. But this is the kind of thing we've been doing for years. We treat these kinds of social ills with police, with jails and so forth. We do the same thing with schools. We put lots of problems on teachers and schools that really aren't education problems.
So are we asking too much of our prisons?
There's no doubt. There's absolutely no doubt. That's why we see what we have now, a mass incarceration problem. There are people in jails and prisons that definitely belong there. I want to make sure to say that. They can't live out among us. They are predators. But that's actually a fairly small number relative to the number we have incarcerated. We can't abolish prisons. I'm not in that camp, though there are people who say so. But we could do with far less people in them, put those resources into our communities to keep people from going to prison in the first place. But when they have these kinds of problems, like opiate addiction, to treat that outside in the community as the public health problem that it very clearly is. When we put that into the prison system, there is no chance that the prison system will be able to cope and do as good a job as our outside agencies could. And it's not their fault.
So how might this appellate court decision change what's happening now, or maybe lead to a change?
Well, it's a kind of leading case that other courts of appeal and federal district courts will look at and say, if a person comes into the system with an addiction problem that has been treated with medication, at least one high up federal court has said you can't just discontinue that treatment arbitrarily. You got to go ahead and treat it. So it will be looked at as a leading precedent. Even outside the four states in Puerto Rico where it governs, it's going to be something lots of courts will look to.
David Harris is WESA's legal analyst, a University of Pittsburgh law professor, and he is the host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. David, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Kevin.
And that appellate court ruling that David was talking about out of Boston regarding a prisoner receiving medication, does not have a legal effect in Pennsylvania. Why? Because our state is part of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, not the First. However, just days after that Boston court ruling, the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections announced a new policy. Sarah Bowden is WESA's health reporter. She joins us now. Sarah, welcome.
Hey, Kevin.
So do we know if Pennsylvania was feeling any legal heat? And, you know, to get out ahead of it before maybe a suit was filed here?
When I spoke to the DOC, I wouldn't use the term legal heat, but they were definitely aware of what was happening in the First Circuit and decided to be proactive with this new policy.
All right. So in announcing this policy, I want to know, did the corrections officials refer to it as a health issue?
I think they see it definitely as a health issue. I think that they understand, the people who I spoke with understand that substance use dependency or use disorder is definitely a medical condition.
New policy takes effect when? June 1st, is it?
June 1st, yes.
So who does it apply to?
Right now it applies to people who are already taking medication-assisted treatment. So people who are entering the Department of Corrections, often from prisons or on parole, if they're already on this medication, come June 1st, they'll be able to continue these treatments.
And if they're moving maybe from a county lockup into the state system, if that is the case with their sentence?
Exactly. And it's a continuum of care, which I think is, as we just heard David Harris talk about, you know, people are getting more and more of their addiction treatment within incarceration.
Are there any other stipulations regarding this policy?
Well, it has to only do only FDA-approved medications. And
how many are those?
Right now there's three. There are often sometimes medications are used off-label, but right now, really, this only applies to people who have addiction issues when it comes to opioids and alcohol. So folks that are, for example, have issues with methamphetamine, which is a very difficult drug to kick, this doesn't apply to them.
Okay. David was talking a little bit about county jails. They could all have different policies. What have you learned about the Allegheny County Jail?
Allegheny County Jail supplies Vivitrol to all its inmates who would like Vivitrol. This doesn't help with withdrawal. This doesn't help with cravings. What it does do is stop you from getting high off opioids, which is good because when you're released from jail or prison, people are often at a higher risk of overdosing because, you know, their tolerance has right. decreased. But it doesn't help, again, with withdrawal or cravings, which drug withdrawal is incredibly painful. At the state level, in state prisons, they do provide Suboxone, which does help with cravings and withdrawal. So in some ways, the DOC will have a more expansive, or not in some ways, it's just a fact, the DOC will have a more expansive medication-assisted treatment policy than Allegheny County.
As far as the state goes.
Oh, one caveat. Pregnant women do have access to Suboxone, which is a good thing because sometimes withdrawal can lead to miscarriage.
Okay. Any other drugs that possibly could be added to the state corrections list?
Methadone, which is similar to Suboxone in that it helps with cravings and withdrawal.
These medications that you mentioned, they're FDA approved.
Yes.
Are there others that are not federally approved that could help inmates?
You know, anecdotally, I hear that there are some prescription medications that can help people who use methamphetamine. That would be an off-label use. So, and there isn't a whole lot of research there, but withdrawal from any narcotic is really awful.
All right. So we have 30 seconds left. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, though, seemingly a large number of inmates that could
yes.
be affected by this new state policy.
Yes, some 13,600 roughly people enter state prisons every year with a substance use disorder, a quarter of whom are addicted to opioids roughly.
And again, this new policy takes effect?
June 1st.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health reporter. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman has been visiting all 67 counties to get citizen input on whether recreational marijuana should be legalized in Pennsylvania. Fetterman holds two listening sessions in the Pittsburgh area Saturday. We'll speak with the Lieutenant Governor about the feedback he's received so far. If you missed anything from today's program, or if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Joel Yazenkovich and Meg Fair. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.